This is Russ Canelli introducing you to a new science studio. Keith is on travel, and today we're going to learn a little bit about qubits and how they're made from unusual materials. And to tell us about that, we have Dr. Kyriakos Porfiakos from the Department of Materials at the University of Oxford.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to Science Studio. These are very interesting materials that you're going to tell us about, which are called endrohedral fullerenes. Mm-hmm. But for the time, what we'd like to know, getting interested in science, how did you get interested in science?
Well, ever since I was a kid, I was interested in science. But in particular, there was one program that I enjoyed watching when I was a kid, Carl Sagan's Cosmos, and I find that fascinating. And I always, you know, was fascinated by how things work and, you know, the engineering aspect and the scientific aspect. And that's what got me into science, I must say.
I remember, and sometimes we talk about it here in Science Studio, things that I was doing when I was 10 or 12 related to science. Mm-hmm. Can you remind us of some of those things that got you interested?
I was playing around with radios and stuff. So, like kids, we used to make, like, you know, radios and walkie-talkies and talk to each other. We used to have, like, those kits that would buy, and then we have to assemble together. And then we would just go around with my brother and other guys around, like, bushes and trees and try to speak to each other and so on.
You're also from Greece.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, in Thessaloniki in Greece. And then I moved to the UK about 20 years ago.
So you were building these walkie-talkies in Greece.
Correct.
Which must have been somewhat difficult to get the pieces that you needed.
Yeah, well, no, there was like prefab kits that we just have to do a bit of soldering and put some things together with some batteries and so on. So it wasn't that specialized, the stuff that we were looking for. But it was good because it gave us an idea of how things, you know, can go. It gave us the idea to the opportunity to play with magnets as well, which I've always found fascinating, how magnets work and so on.
See, I'm always interested in history, and I know that Greece has this ancient history of science, art. When you brought up in Greece, did that affect your outcome?
It did, yeah. I mean, Euclidean geometry is still being taught today.
Euclidean geometry, yes.
2,500 years after it was first, you know, written by Euclid, it's still written, it's still correct, and it will always be taught whenever, you know, however the universe is going to go forward and humans will be here, they will learn Euclidean geometry. So there's always a long heritage of the Greek tradition
science,
and engineering and art and so on. So, yeah. I mean, a lot of people don't know that, but even the first steam engines were actually made by Heron of Alexandria. And they could use, like, these sophisticated systems to open doors of temples and so on using the power of steam. And that was, again, nearly 2,000 years before steam locomotives and all that happened in Victorian England when it started and so on. So there is a long, long tradition of Greek science. I'm really proud of this.
There were also instances of people faking voices of the gods in temples to scare the people and
yes,
so on.
Yes, yeah, that's correct.
And also some very large warships that were built to defeat the enemies and so on.
Yeah, there's also Archimedes, you know, when he was fighting the Romans in Syracuse, he used to use curved mirrors to concentrate the sun rays to burn the Roman ships.
Oh, my gosh.
So there's a lot of technology that was developed.
You know, we've done a lot of work here in the synchrotrons. Recently, several years ago, a gentleman at the Stanford Synchrotron Radiation Laboratory was able to read an Archimedean text in the original Greek that was under a painting that the monks painted over in, 500 AD or something like that. Are you aware of that?
Aware of this technique, yes. A lot of the old texts have been recovered using this kind of methods, spectroscopy.
Very interesting. So what made you decide to go from Greece to Oxford, or how did you get to Oxford?
Well, I just wanted to expand my horizons, and I went there for a graduate program. And I thought, you know, England was a good option. And Oxford is a big name. I was lucky enough to get an interview to go through. And I stayed there for, you know, I've done my degree. I've done my PhD, DPhil as we call it, in Oxford. And then I stayed there as a postdoctoral research assistant initially. And then I got to have my own research group. And I continued like that, working with molecules.
Well, tell us a little bit about your degree.
It was in
Are my you a
first,
chemist? Or?
My first degree is in chemical engineering.
Chemical engineering, yes.
And my PhD and my master's and PhD were in material science.
Very similar to my background, too.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. How did you get interested in materials? I know I've always been interested in you know, both theory of materials and application.
It was polymers that drew my interest, actually, because I was always interested in polymers, the science and technology and the applications of that. And that's, it's part of the materials. We did that when I was an undergraduate in Greece. There was no independent department of materials. It was part of the chemical engineering. But, I got an interest in that. And that's why I got interested in carbon-based materials in general.
Well, I remember, some time back there was all this excitement about conducting polymers.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to have disappeared.
It has subsided a bit, but it's still going on. There's a lot of research going on conducting polymers. In fact, people have got the opportunity now to impregnate them with carbon nanotubes and graphene and other materials with good electronic properties, and that's how they can get the conductivity into polymers like that. So they're still going on, but the major thing on the electronic properties of polymers, let's say, is on energy applications, solar cells, flexible solar panels, and so on. All of that stuff is with conducting polymers.
Seems to me I remember somebody, maybe it was at Allied Chemical, was working on polycarbon diselenide. That was the thing that people thought was going to be a new conducting, maybe even superconducting mm-hmm. polymer. And when you talk about putting carbon nanotubes or graphene, which are forms of carbon, into a conventional polymer, that's sort of a hybrid material.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's not really something that conducts naturally in a sense.
No, correct. It's the conductivity of the nanotubes and the graphene that introduces the conductivity in the polymer as well.
What is a carbon nanotube?
It is a material, it looks like a tube, like chicken wire, that if you can roll it together and form a tube, so it's got this hexagon-like structures on the side walls, and it's made entirely out of carbon. So if you think like a piece of chicken wire where its cross point is a carbon atom, and you roll that into a tube, you can make a carbon nanotube. If you just take one of these chicken wires, one flat sheet of that, is what graphene is. And if you can roll it together in a spherical structure, is what a fullerene is.
Yeah.
So it's effectively, they're all allotropes of carbon. They're made entirely out of carbon.
Yeah, and everybody has been quite interested in graphene,
mm-hmm.
which are the single layers of graphite, really.
Indeed.
So tell us a little bit more. Why are they so interesting?
Because they are a two-dimensional material. It's like a two-dimensional crystal. People debated the existence of two-dimensional crystals for a long time, and graphene has shown that it can be a stable two-dimensional crystal. It's having one atom-thick layer. And because of this extraordinary structure, you can have a lot of quantum properties. You can observe quantum phenomena at room temperature using graphene and so on. So that's remarkable. You know, no one was able to do this kind of measurements before the development of graphene.
Please give us an example of a quantum measurement for our audience out there that you could make in a single layer that you cannot make in an extended solid.
It's true. There's like Kondo effects. You know, there's like this kind of physical effects. One of them is the Kondo effect. Kondo effect. Yeah,
yeah.
It's named after a scientist. And those cannot be observed in other systems at room temperatures and so on. To get the story back a little bit, just to go in the quantum story, the quantum mechanics is quite complicated. I mean, it's true to say that nobody quite understands quantum mechanics, as famously Feynman put it together.
Yeah.
However, all the experiments have been done so far have shown that subatomic or atomic systems, or molecules in some cases, are quantum objects. And that means that you can find them in a superposition of states. That means one electron can be in two places at once. And things like you and I cannot see in the classical world. You know, in the big classical world that we see each other, we cannot be at two places at the same time, but an electron can be. These kind of measurements are very fragile, though. These kind of superpositions, as they're called, of the states are very fragile, so it's very difficult to measure them. And Heisenberg was one of the sort of founding fathers of the mathematical aspects of the quantum theory, and he incorporated this constant of like the statistical effect, the concept of statistical effect of quantum mechanics. And of course Einstein never liked that, and that's why he coined the famous phrase, God does not play dice with the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And you might have heard also of Schrödinger's cat, the experiment.
Schrödinger's cat it's either in the box, it's either alive or dead, and it could be both alive and
That's
dead.
That's right. Before you actually open up the box, the cat is both alive and dead. That's the point. That's the weird point of it. Once you open the box, the cat will be either dead or alive, depending on the, how the condom's position collapses. And that's the whole thing, to go back to the graphene story. All these kinds of measurements, because they're very fragile and difficult to observe, they need very, very special circumstances, like very, very low temperatures, very specific equipment and all that. With graphene, people manage to start to observe these kind of measurements and experiments at room temperature in hot systems like this. So that's what has attracted quite a lot.
One of the things you're saying is that the quantum world is very small, but in the Schrodinger example, we can't observe the cat alive or dead until we open the box and it collapses and it's either alive or dead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how is it that we're able to observe some of these quantum effects?
Well, if we can measure, instead of like a macroscopic object like a cat, if we can actually do experiments with subatomic particles, electrons or atoms or nuclei, we can actually observe them being at two places at once or having their spin up or down, as it is called, simultaneously. In fact, there is the famous Young's double slit experiment with light. Thomas Young in the 1700s managed to push light through a double slit, and he saw that this interference pattern at the back, which shows that wherever there is constructive or destructive interference, there are peaks and troughs in the wall. This experiment has been repeated with electrons firing single one electron at a time using single electron sources that exist at the moment, and this interference pattern appeared again. Imagine having one single electron going through a double slit and building up these interference patterns. The only way for that to happen is as if the electron would pass through the slits simultaneously. And that has been shown experimentally. This is what, you know, how nature behaves at the very small. It is weird, it's counterintuitive, but that's what happens. Experiments have confirmed that. Alan Aspect famously won them a Nobel Prize in Physics in the 80s, if I remember correctly, on doing this kind of experiment with photons, with the optical experiments. So all experimental work so far has vindicated the quantum mechanics theory of the world in the nanoscale.
I was reading an article about a Monet painting, which is in a bedroom and the sun is there. And recently the European Space Agency, I believe, figured out exactly where that room was and what time it was, because they have this technique where they're looking at all the stars through a slit.
Oh, that's fascinating. I haven't heard about that.
Yeah, it was just in the news. The scientist, whose name escapes me at the moment, said it was on a Friday morning at 7 o'clock and it was in this room at so many degrees and so on and so forth. So
That's great, yeah.
Fascinating that people can go back and reconstruct some of these things like that, Quantum mechanics, as you said, is something that sort of disturbs everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
But is really very, very important to the future of electronics and all sorts of devices.
Absolutely, and that because, I mean, we're all familiar with Moore's Law. Gordon Moore was one of the co-founders of Intel, and in the 60s he predicted that about every 18 months or so, the speed of the computers will double, which is the case. But this can't go on forever. There are quantum limits that we're close to reaching at the moment. That means we cannot continue making smaller and smaller transistors as the current technology does. So this cannot go forever. Of course, computers will continue to develop. And quantum computing is one of the alternative ways of doing computation by using the quantum properties of particles and molecules.
You are listening to Science Studio, where our guest is Kyriakos Porphyrakis, who's going to come back in a minute and tell us about his work. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Hey, Norbert, did you know Lyme disease is on the uptick?
Oh, brother.
What? Anyway, Lyme disease is a bacterial infection people get through bites from infected ticks. It's the most commonly reported vector-borne illness in the U.S. that's transmitted by a blood-sucking arthropod.
Even though we only first identified this disease in 1970, scientists recently found the bacteria in 15 to 20 million-year-old amber. That's long before humans walked the earth. So it's a good bet the bacteria infected many ancient organisms.
The chunk of amber was found in the Dominican Republic and had trapped four ticks. Scientists have long studied seeds, leaves, feathers, and insects preserved by tree resin, which fossilizes over millions of years and forms amber, a semi-precious stone.
Inside these ancient ticks were large populations of the type of bacteria that resemble the modern-day Borrelia bacteria, which cause Lyme disease. They're the oldest fossil evidence associating the arthropods with the bacteria. Though 20 million years seems like a long time ago, bacteria actually arose some 3.6 billion years ago.
Ticks are vectors for a wide variety of microbes that cause disease in animals as well as humans. The oldest reported case of Lyme disease in humans was Ötzi, the well-preserved ice mummy who lived 5,000 years ago and was discovered by hikers in the Alps.
Ticks were also found to carry the Rickettsia bacteria as long as 100 million years ago. It's possible dinosaurs may have been infected with Rickettsia, which today causes spotted fever and typhus in humans.
Millions of years of coevolution has left us with highly adapted pathogens that scientists and physicians still struggle to understand and treat.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. I'm Russ Canelli, and we're talking to Kyriakos Porfiakos. He's going to tell us about these fullerenes, which encapsulate atoms, that is his work, and promise some new devices and new applications for us. Please tell us about your work.
Okay. So fullerenes, they're spherical molecules, and because they've got a gap in their hollow interior, we can actually put atoms in there. And these are called endohedral fullerenes, which means they contain things inside the polyhedron structure. And because we can put atoms inside there, we can induce electronic properties. For example, the spin of the electron of the encapsulated atom can be used as a quantum bit or a qubit. And that's what my group is working on, trying to see if these molecules can be used for quantum computers. And that means they have to have certain requirements, like long lifetimes of the spin and so on. But so far, the experiments we've done show that it's feasible, it's possible, that these molecules can be the building blocks of a quantum computer.
All right, let's back up a little bit. Can you tell our audience a little bit more about what a fullerene is?
Yeah, they're like a molecule that's made out of carbon atoms. It's like a football, or soccer, as you call it.
Yeah.
The smallest one is like carbon 60, 60 carbon atoms put together, and that forms a very stable structure. That's what a fullerene is.
And it's six and five-membered rings, right, connected like a soccer ball.
Correct.
Are there other forms that are coming?
There are C70, C84, bigger cages, up to C100 or even more. Yeah, there's lots of them.
So there's a whole family of larger and larger buckyballs.
Correct, correct. And some of them can be full or some of them can be empty. Those, the full ones with other atoms, are the endohedral species.
So I imagine when you fill one, it has to be a simultaneous, because you can't just stick it in there if it's closed, right? So you have to construct.
Most of them are made like that, yes. They're made at the same time.
Can you give us some examples of atoms that you put in there?
Yeah, group 3 elements, scandium, yttrium, most of the lanthanides have been inserted, but also nitrogen, phosphorus, and other elements have been made endohedral, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about which ones particularly you've worked on.
So I work on a molecule called nitrogen HC60, where a nitrogen atom is inserted inside the cage. And in that particular cage, you actually bombard it with nitrogen. So we put the nitrogen after we form the cage.
Yeah, so the nitrogen can get through
if you get
closed ball.
The right energy, yeah. And some of them get trapped inside there, and they form this molecule. And that's got a very, very, very long lifetime of the spin, as we call it. And that's what makes it very attractive for quantum information processing. Because nitrogen is a very reactive element. It doesn't like to stay on its own. But inside the buckyball, it stabilizes somehow. And that means you have unpaired electrons. It's like an atomic nitrogen with unpaired electrons. And these unpaired electrons have got spin. And because that spin is isolated from the environment, that's what makes it very, very, very long lifetime. That spin has got a very long lifetime. We're talking about quarter of a millisecond, which is very long for spin state.
So it's almost like thinking about what we were talking about before. If the nitrogen is the cat and you put it in
absolutely,
the box.
Absolutely. The box is a fullerene and the nitrogen is a cat, yeah.
And therefore, it can do whatever it wants with its electrons that can be in different places at the same time.
That's right. And we can use algorithms to manipulate those using magnetic fields.
So we might call it, I don't know if somebody has, quantum entrapment by the buckyball.
Yes, it is, in a sense, an entrapment, yes. But the important thing is that we have developed and we have measured experimentally we have seen the superposition and entanglement of fullerenes.
Okay, so you've made these and measured them. Tell us what kind of measurements you make to determine what's happening inside.
We use a EPR spectroscopy, electron paramagnetic resonance, and that measures the spin lifetimes. It can tell you if there is coupling. I mean, I should correct it. It's not quite entanglement, just coupling between different spin electron spins. But using this EPR technique, which is an equivalent of an NMR, but instead of nuclear spin, we're looking at electron spins.
Right.
We can actually use microwave pulses, and we can flip the spins. We can turn them from up and down, for example, and that's making like a NOT gate, a 0-1 transition. And we can also measure the lifetime of the spin, and we can even see if we put two of them together, if there is coupling between the two. And this is the first step to show that entanglement is taking place. They have to talk to each other. There's going to be coupled. So if we're able to manipulate them individually and then show that there's coupling with each other, then we're in a good position to demonstrate entanglement. That's where we are now. That's what we're striving to achieve, to demonstrate entanglement in these two-qubit systems. But so far, they tick the boxes.
All right. So when you make this material, is it something that's stable at room temperature, or do you have to keep it at special conditions?
It is quite stable at room temperature, but you are right that there are some things that you have to take into account. For example, as I said, because nitrogen is a very reactive species, nitrogen doesn't like to stay in its atomic state very much. It wants to do, all it wants to do is go and find another nitrogen and make an N2 molecule.
Yeah, right.
And you know, this N2, the triple bond between two nitrogen atoms in an N2 molecule is one of the strongest in the universe.
Yeah.
However, if you put it, as I said, inside the buckyball, the wave function just about fits snugly inside the buckyball, so it is stable. But if you give it a bit of energy, it will start to rattle inside the cage. Once it starts to rattle inside the cage, it may bond on the carbon bonds on the cage, and it can flip out and escape. That's why you have to protect it from light, from energy, from heating it up, and so on. So you have to keep it, your solution of the molecules, you have to keep it like in a dark vial in a cupboard, for example. If you do that, it lasts for a long time, for years. But if you start to expose it to light or thermally heat it up and so on, it will decay. The signal will decay over time, which means that the nitrogen will start to escape from the cage. The cage won't be destroyed, just the nitrogen will start to come out. So you do have to take some care of how you store these molecules. But at room temperature, in the dark, as I said, they last forever.
So that's interesting. What you're doing is you have these fullerenes in a dark room, if you will, and you're bombarding them with nitrogen. And how do you do that? Just keep the pressure up, or do you?
We use the technique called ion implantation.
Yeah.
Where we use an ion source, which is we can feed it with nitrogen gas, and that can create nitrogen ions due to thermionic ionization. And those nitrogen ions are fired inside the vacuum chamber, where fullerenes are sublimed onto a target. So effectively, it's trying to hit the bullet with a bullet. We're trying to impregnate the fullerenes with the nitrogen. In vacuum, in a vacuum system. So that's why the yield of this process is very small, only 10 to the minus 4, which means one every 10,000 buckyballs will actually contain one nitrogen atom inside them. But we can still
measure it, sure.
Measure it and isolate it and characterize it, yeah.
So when you're bombarding it, it's not N2 anymore. It's broken?
Yes, it's ionized. So
it's ionized.
So it's actually N+.
N plus.
Yes, because the ion source that we have, it's got a mass separating system, so it separates the N2 pluses from the N pluses. So we fire into the chamber the N plus ions. Those, they hit the cage, and as the cage conducts the copper grid that is connected to it, it loses the charge. So it becomes NHC60 neutral without any charge.
Tell the audience why a qubit is important, and how you might be able to make some new devices and so on with a qubit.
Mm-hmm.
Don't we have qubits now that are...
There are. I mean, there's a lot of work going on. The endohedral fullerenes, the molecules that I'm talking about, there's only one effort to try to use these materials to embody quantum information. There's a lot of different alternative types of qubits, and I would say that quite a lot of them are more successful so far than the endohedral fullerenes. For example, there's superconducting qubits, or squids, as they're called.
Mm-hmm.
There's solid-state systems like phosphorus impurities in silicon, ion traps, all sorts of different efforts all over the world. There are groups that work on different embodiments of quantum information. And why it is important is because, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, quantum computing is an alternative way of doing computation that for some kinds of measurements, it's a lot more powerful than a standard computer. I'll give you an example, if you like, for cryptography systems. When you go to an internet website and it's secure site, it says 128-bit security, the website, yeah? That means that there is a keyword with 128 bits or like 128 digits that in order to hack into that website, you have to find the factors of that number, for example, like to factorize this. Even with a faster supercomputer that exists at the moment, this kind of factorization takes a very, very long time. There are some kinds of problems like this, like factorizing large numbers or simulating quantum system like protein folding and so on, that even the fastest supercomputer that exists on the planet nowadays will take hundreds of years to solve. If you had a fully working quantum computer with only 100 qubits, not billions of bits like current computers we have, you would be able to solve this factorization in a few minutes. That's how much faster the quantum computer could be in this kind of problems compared to a classical computer.
Well, that to me sounds like it could create a problem too, because doesn't that mean you could hack somebody's computer faster?
Indeed. I mean, banks, the military, the sort of defense organizations are all interested in getting their hands on a quantum computer for those kind of reasons that you mentioned, yeah.
So that you could actually defend better if you had a quantum computer.
That's right. With quantum cryptography can, in theory, be completely impossible to break. So if you could have a quantum cryptography system, it will be completely impossible to be hacked without you knowing it.
Oh, I see. Okay. So there will be an alarm that says somebody's in there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I often think of the fact that maybe someday we'll discover that we can attack back the computer that's hacking us in some fashion.
But, yeah, as I said, there are these kind of problems. For example, not for word processing, for writing documents or like other kind of mundane tasks, the quantum computer won't offer any further advantage than a classical computer. But for this kind of hard mathematical problems, the quantum computer would offer a huge step in advance. And that's why it is attractive. I believe in our lifetimes we will see a working quantum computer.
So does that mean that when we have these quantum computers, we're going to be able to understand the quantum universe better?
I hope so. That's the whole idea, to study quantum systems, to study the folding of proteins, you know, the photosynthesis, the transformation of light into energy using the plant leaves, all of the like quantum processes that exist in nature that were very difficult to study and understand. Quantum computers might shed some light on.
Not quantum entanglement?
Quantum entanglement will be with us for a long time, and I think the debate will go on for a long time. Quantum teleportation is another sort of fascinating.
They are now quantum teleporting particles.
Yes, photons can be teleported already. There are experiments that are showing this. In theory, even a whole human being could be teleported if they would be able to break it down into trillions of particles that make it up and teleport each of them individually and then build it up together at the other side. That would happen as well. It sounds like science fiction. It sounds like Star Trek and Beam Me Up, Scotty and all this, but nature does not disallow this to happen. And what nature doesn't disallow usually happens.
Now what you're telling us is that the quantum entanglement is actually making that conceivable.
It is. I mean, there are experiments that happened in Europe and in the U.S. that show the quantum teleportation of particles, of individual photons.
Well, we're very happy that you came here to talk to us today, and we hope that you'll come back to Science Studio in the near future and tell us about these things. And our guest today has been Kyriakos Porfiriakis, and he's from the Department of Materials at the University of Oxford in England. And thank you very much for being here, and thanks to Norma, our producer.
Thank you very much for having me.
With your Synapse Flash. Dynamica Expo has issued a call for poster abstracts. Deadline to submit is October 31st. Up to $10,000 in cash awards will be given. Dynamica Expo is El Paso's largest healthcare innovation conference. It takes place November 14th and 15th. Learn more at dynamicaexpo.org. Support for Synapse comes from the Sierra Providence Health Network.